So how much have people brought up the Kubrick tone in this, the influence, whatever you want to call it?
Well, somebody brought it up in the Q&A last night, I guess.
At the
screening.
Okay.
As one of the people in the audience when we were doing the question and answers.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I mean, I've worked with a lot of filmmakers, and
I felt echoes of, I presume that the narration is straight from the book.
Some of it is, and some of it's stuff that Tom and I invented, and some of it's stuff that I invented when I was in rehearsal with the actors, too.
It's awfully nice. I mean, it's very succinct, not overly written. It's very good.
Well, I have Tom Prada to thank for that. I think he's a great, great writer, and a wonderful satirist.
The echo that I heard in my ear, anyway, was a little bit of a tone, not the same, but I felt similarities in the Barry Lyndon narration. It's the voice of someone who's kind of who's not in there with the characters, but, you know, obviously removed, a little sardonic, a little amused, but aware of the tragic.
Yeah, well, the narrator of this film, in short, is a grown-up. But I don't think he's judging these characters. That certainly wasn't the intent.
Mm-hmm.
He offers a counterpoint. It's a conceit of a satirical melodrama, which is, it's not a genre that people are leaping to to embrace, I don't think. I mean, there's only very few satirical melodramas that even come to mind and that are some of my favorite films, and they all use third-person narration as a way of framing satirical melodrama. Most of that comes from English literature, and by English literature I mean English literature, not American literature. So there is some kind of transposition there, but the main, you know, when we first started to talk about a screenplay, and Tom and I sat there, I said, "Listen, I'm attracted to your voice." Your form of passive observation, and we're dealing with satirical melodrama here. We have an opportunity. Let's use it. You know,
mm-hmm.
I mean, there are people that will always tell you that, you know, using narration of any sort, whether it's third person, first person, or otherwise, is a mark of amateur filmmaking or shoddy work or all of that sort of supposed movie know-how from, you know, people that think that there are dyed-in-the-wool cinematic truths, but and I understand that. You know, I mean, I certainly worked on Roger Corman movies when I was a young actor, where they'd come in and try to fix stuff because they didn't have the shots, and say, "Well, you know, Francis the Old Mule went down to the canyon and met the old prospector, and then he, you know, I mean." So I understand when people crow about that stuff, but this screenplay was built around that narration for very specific reasons. And yes, you know, it could have been dropped entirely and I could have still made a satirical melodrama, but I wasn't interested in that. It was a new form. I'd never done it before. I'd only done straight up dramas all through film school, and it seemed like an opportunity to experiment.
What struck me in the similarity between this and In the Bedroom is that there's a feeling develops very early on, and you can just feel it. It's in the timing of it, it's in the texture of it, but you can just feel that something pretty awful could happen at any moment. You can feel that in the beginning of In the Bedroom. You can sense that with, you know, I don't know, maybe that's just what we all carry around when we're out there. You know, life itself, you have the feeling that, you know, something.
Well, we live in an anxious time. We do. I mean, we live in anxious times. That, you know, we live in a world where there's a lot to worry about, or we're told there's a lot to worry about. You know, be careful. There's evil doers out there, and let's go. You know, we better go kill them before they kill us. And be careful. You know, don't think this way because then you might be this kind of person. And be careful, and don't do that because people might think you're that kind of person. We typecast each other. We typecast the entire world. And I think there is a heightened sense of anxiety where we have fear shoved down our throats. Everywhere we turn, we're bombarded by it. And I think there's a sense of inertia that sets in where we're afraid to go forward because we're afraid that we'll make the wrong move, as if there is a wrong move, you know? And a sense of shame that we haven't gotten it right, as if there is a right, as if there are rules. And yeah, they're anxious times. You know?
I was fascinated to hear. I didn't pick this up until just a while ago. I was talking to Patrick that it was all just outside of New York, Queens, Long Island.
Yeah, Staten Island and Jersey. Yeah.
It just felt so Massachusetts to me, North. You know.
Well, we were looking for that. I mean, the story's set in this bedroom community, this fictitious bedroom community of Massachusetts in the novel. And I was concerned because I had no intention of doing a send-up of suburbia or those little people, or because I don't feel that way. I grew up in suburbia. I lived in New York City. I've lived in the middle of nowhere in Maine. I've lived in London, England. I've lived everywhere. I don't believe there are those little people. I believe that we're very complicated, you know, creatures. And so I was nervous when I first read the book. I thought, I really don't want to. That field's been plowed by Cheever and Yeats and plenty of other people, from Ang Lee to, you know, to Sam Mendes, for that matter. And it doesn't need to be plowed anymore. And also, I just don't have anything to comment on in terms of suburbia. I felt like I responded to these characters and the situations they're in for reasons that had to do with what Parada had laid out, and the story could have just as easily taken place around a watering hole in Pakistan, and these women could be in burqas pointing at each other and gossiping at each other, and the men could be playing soccer in a minefield, for that matter. The fact that it takes place in a, you know, what we consider a suburbia, in our sort of predisposition to want to raise our eyebrows and be a little arch about suburbia, was completely beside the point.
Mm. Did you ever read John Updike's Couples?
I haven't read that. I've read all the rabbit stories, but
I was thinking about that also. It's just, you know, it's about a lot of sexual stuff going on, and just, you know, there's a lot of riches in your film, and I just was thinking about. I absolutely love. I know that I was going over with Leo a little bit, and also some others, about the trailer, the wonderful trailer. And I love the, you know, that line. I'm just thinking about success has 100 founders and failure has an orphan.
It was. We sat down and had a meeting, and I said, I want a trailer that has no stories overrated.
Did they feel that way? Marketing people?
They were very open to that. I said, look, the story of this is very simple. You know, it's not, the story lays out, plot is an excuse to spend time with characters. And I don't want a trailer with plot or story or dialogue or music. I just want something that's going to hopefully evoke something. And Laura Carrillo handled the trailer, and who worked on the one sheet with me, you know, was really open to that, and as was Woolman. And I met with Woolman, and I said, do something that would impress yourself that you don't think any studio would ever want. Just do something that really, really interests you. And it can be anything. It could just be sound. It could be a train. It could be whatever. And they came back with a version of... Leo and I had cut together some teasers, and they took that and they sort of dovetailed it into this larger idea, which was a very, very long piece. And You know, and then we refined it and refined it and refined it and refined it until it was what it was. But it was a piece of collective thought. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't claim credit for anything, and I don't think it really matters. It's a piece of marketing, and I'm happy with, you know, how it turned out.
It's funny how I thought the first time, first couple of times, I had in my mind that there wasn't any dialogue, but then of course there is. But
there's a couple of lines. Just a few lines. There's Kate has a line, and Jennifer has a few lines, and that's it.
The refusal to accept
a life of unhappiness.
Right. Yeah. It's like the quintessential sort of line in the movie for me. It's kind of. You know. Mm-hmm. I also love that shot. Did you have anything to do with it at the time ago?
No. It's going.
She looks like she's on heroin. It's perfect. Is that from the film, or is that something that they did for the marketing?
Oh, no. When they called and they said, what do you want to do about the one sheet, I said, look, I'd either like something that's completely iconographic, like a piece of artwork with no actors, mm-hmm. but we want to have the actors, and there's an image that I've been desperate to get into the film, and I can't find a place for it. Mm-hmm. When we did their love scenes, it was just Patrick, Kate, and me alone. Crew stand outside for 2 days. No one was allowed inside, and we operated the camera, and we talked through scene by scene, and we just went about doing it, which was a terrific opportunity, a rare opportunity to be able to be alone with your actors that way, and doing very specific work, which was beside the fact that they had their clothes off. They had to act very specific things within that. They just happened to be unclothed. So to remove the element of titillation for a crew or anything like that was really imperative. And mm-hmm. when we finished, Kate said, you know, let's do one more shot. And I said, well, what is it? She said, we've just had sex all day long, and we're both completely spent, and we're just lying there breathing. And I said, okay, that's a good idea. And so they lay down, and I filmed them for like 5 minutes, just breathing. And the last minute, I said, cut. And at that very last minute, Patrick's eyes flipped over for one frame at the camera, and I cut it. Mm-hmm. And I saw that in the editing room, and I mentioned it to Laura Carrillo at New Line, and I said, there's a frame we should pull. Let's pull it from the motion, you know, right from the camera negative. So we pulled it out of the camera, and we pulled out that one negative, and this is what the three of us made, this picture, Kate, Patrick, and I. No one else was involved. And I mean, that's
perfect.
And that's there. I mean, that's in the picture. Right. It wasn't added.
I was going to assume that was probably added.
It wasn't. No, oddly enough, it was there. It was very strange. And then Laura said, should we remove that? And I said, no, let's just leave it. You know?
I never asked this, but it doesn't really matter. But was this done on a real shoestring, or did you have more money because of In the Bedroom? Did you have more to work?
We had a larger budget, but we also, because our production schedule was twice as long, because the 3.5-year-old children that are in the film are only in it. They're in there for 40% of the production schedule. Well, you can only shoot 6-hour days with them, so it nearly doubles your production budget because it doubles your schedule. Mm-hmm. So. That, yeah, absolutely increased the budget based on the fact that you have such tiny, you know, kids that can work finite hours.
I'm sorry for not doing my reading, but the mother who plays Jackie, or Haley's mom,
Phyllis Somerville.
What would I have seen her in? Do I know her from something?
Probably not. She's a great stage actress. She works at the O'Neill.
She's really strong.
She's fantastic. Yeah, she's absolutely fantastic. And I saw probably 50 actresses before she walked in the door. Huh. I mean, I knew it when I sat down and read with her. Huh. I just thought, oh God, finally, there she is.
You know? Is the note to him, be a good boy, is that in the book, or is that, you know, from...
That's in the book, yeah.
That was really something that from that point on to the end, it was really... It was feeling of great completeness. And also Patrick's sense of relief and happiness that the skateboard kids.
He's frozen. He was 15 when his mother dies, you know, and he hasn't been able to cross over that adolescence to adulthood. And he had to fly. You know, he never got a chance to fly when he was 15, and now he's taken a flight, and and he's crashed and woken up. You know, when he says, "Where am I?" Yeah. And he says, "Where am I?" It's almost like he's Dorothy waking up in Kansas. It's like he's been in the Oz, and they're like, "We're here. Everything's okay." You know,
12 foot. Very nice. I wish we could talk longer.
Yeah, me too. I'm sorry. I would have liked to have had a longer conversation with you. We can keep talking.
Maybe can I email you at a later point?
Sure, absolutely. Yeah.
Where?
Yeah, absolutely. It's let me write down my email address. So.
Maybe we could just do a chat closer. Is it? It's October.
Sixth. Yeah.
Pretty soon.